My name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 163. I'm recording it on Tuesday, September 1st, 2009. The P10 level today is 18. That's better than what we had prior to the stock crash, better than any P10 level we saw from 1996 through 2008. So it is an improvement, but it's still a little dangerous for stocks. So stocks are sort of a mixed bag today, the long-term value proposition. The music for this podcast, the title is Clowns on Fire. The title of the podcast is Buffett Disappoints. I'm going to warn you before I start. In a recent podcast, I went through a list of the different types of podcasts, and I mentioned that one that even my most loyal listeners try to avoid are the sermon type. We have the cutting edge podcasts that go into stuff not reported anywhere else in the literature, and we have the strategy podcasts that tell you what to do with your money, which is tend to be the favorites, and we have the funny ones, which are my favorites, but there's not too many of those. And the numbers-oriented ones, which I shouldn't be doing, but I have to do because no one else, or not no one else, but too few in this field report the numbers accurately. But another type of podcast is the sermon podcast. And these are the ones where I argue that we all need to play nicely and we all need to open up the internet to honest posting on the effective valuations on long-term returns. And we all need to rebuild the retire early and indexing discussion boards and all this sort of thing. And the sermons are the least popular for reasons it just no one can understand. What is it that people don't like about these sermons? Well, I believe we need the sermons. I believe we need it's sort of a situation where if we make progress on any of these areas, we'll make progress on all the others. In other words, if we can get people to understand the numbers, they will want to open the internet up to honest posting. And they understand the cutting edge stuff and the strategy and all that. But we can't really help too many people understand the strategy or numbers or cutting edge stuff if we don't open the internet up to honest posting on valuations, can we? So it's a situation where we need to attack the problem from several different directions. And so I think the sermon podcast have a place. And this is going to be one of those. But if you absolutely cannot stand the sermon podcast, you might want to find another way to spend the next hour of your life energy rather than listening to how this goes. But I make an effort not to do too many sermons. I know that we can only take so much. And just as the church only makes you attend services once a week, or for some of us once or twice a year, for some of us never, we try to space the sermons in with the other more fun types of stuff. And I'll try to throw in a joke or two and make the sermons a little fun. Let's see. I have one more prefatory note. I wanted to, before we get to the meat of Buffett Disappoints, I did the last two podcasts. One was called the Time Price Connection, and then the next one was called I Was Wrong, There Is No Equity Risk Premium. Those are exciting podcasts in the sense that they weren't as clear. At least the first one wasn't as clear as it should have been because I was still thinking through the issue. But in a long-term sense, I think the points made, especially in the last of those two, are important. And there was one little point that hit me even after doing the second one. So I just wanted to mention that. I struggled and struggled to answer this man's question that he put to the Bogleheads.org board, where he said, if future returns, if the fact that stocks are going to continue to provide good returns in the future is baked into today's price, why is it that stock prices ever go up? And I thought that was a great question. Because I do believe future returns are baked in. And Warren Buffett, the subject of this podcast, although I'm going to be talking about a lot of things that aren't directly relating to Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett has explained, really, why this is so. He said, or at least he's explained why the poster had a puzzle to deal with. Warren Buffett has said the price of stocks is the discounted value. I don't know that I'm quoting him exactly, but this is the idea. The discounted value of the future income stream or the future dividend stream coming from ownership of that stock, or in the case of an index fund, it comes from ownership of a share of U.S. productivity. And the puzzle is, if that future income stream is baked into today's price, why is it that the price goes up on average 6.5% real per year? Why didn't the price just stay the same? And here's a way of understanding it that I think is clearer than anything I said in the earlier two podcasts. I think Buffett is right. I think today's price is essentially, I hope that he's right about this. I don't put my faith in too much of anything anymore. The experts have been wrong about so many things, but I'm going to assume, for at least for now, that Buffett is right, that the price is the discounted value of the future revenue stream from that share of stock. So what's happening is we're looking out into the future now, and we're saying, you know, I'm going to get these returns. You know, I'm not going to get them. In other words, if you were to get a 6.5% real return today, you would price in the full value of that. But if you're not going to get the 6.5 return, say, till 5 years in the future, well, you're not going to increase the price of the stock by 6.5. You're going to discount it. It's not worth as much because it's 5 years out. Now, a question that I have never heard Buffett answer, or it's possible that he has, and I just don't know about it. I don't follow Buffett's work. I mean, I admire it, but I don't follow it closely. I just don't have time to do that. So it's possible he's answered this question, and I just don't know. But I don't think so. I don't think he has ever said how many years out. When we say it's discounting future income streams or dividend streams, how far out do you go? Is it 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, 100 years, 1,000 years? I mean, you can't go 1,000 years out. You know, I mean, what would it be worth? A penny? I don't think it's ever specified. I think the understanding is just that it's sort of a, I think it's a good definition of how the price is set, but you can't specify a number of years, I don't believe. You just sort of say, well, the further you go out, the more it's going to be discounted, and at some point you're out so far that the discounted value is essentially zero. It's just recorded as zero. So I think what happens each year is that let's just call the amount of time you go out into the future, let's call that X. X years. I don't know how many years X is, but it's X. Well, as we complete a new year, as the year 2009 comes to a close, we're now going out not X, but X plus one. In other words, every year we're going out one additional year than we were before. Whatever X is, as another 12 months passes by, we're going out not X, but X plus one. Well, when you go out X plus one, that makes the price X, which is what the price was before the year started, plus one. And 1 year is 6.5 real return. So each year, the price of an index, of a broad index, has to increase by 6.5% real in order to keep up with the realities. Obviously, stocks don't go up 6.5% real every year. But if they were to keep up with the realities, they would have to. Because productivity is such as to support, to finance a 6.5% real gain every year, roughly. So we're seeing the real value of stocks goes up by that amount every year. Now, you know, of course, the problem you get into is with valuation. And as long as that's reflected, as long as the real gain is reflected in the price properly, as long as the gain in stocks is 6.5 real, the P/10 level will stay constant. It'll stay at 14 or 15, something like that. But then when you have these years where you have a 30% gain, not a 6.5% gain, as we did in the late 90s, well, then you're going to have a built-in loss. You need to incur a loss of, say, 24% to bring the price of stocks back to their real value. So every time you have gains bigger than 6.5, there's a built-in loss that is incurred and then baked in, so to speak, into the price. And anytime you have a gain of less than 6.5, you have a future gain baked into the price. And of course, this is why passive investing can never work, because passive investing ignores the baked in gains and losses. Passive investing assumes that the most likely return, implicitly, it assumes that the most likely return every year is 6.5, even following a year in which there's been a 30% gain, or even following 5 years in which there have been 30% gains every year. Passive investing just always resets. It just ignores the fact that the current year's return is artificial and phony and fake, and just pretends everything's fine. You can still count on 6.5. And the historical data says, and common sense, say no, that can't be so. When you have crazy increases, you're going to have crazy decreases a couple years later. And when you have crazy decreases, you're going to have crazy increases a couple years later. But I think it helps in terms of trying to answer that fellow's question. It's only taken me 3 podcasts to do it. that what's really going on is that his question was, why would there be a gain in price when that gain was expected? It should have already been baked in. It was baked in. But the passage of time has to be reflected in the price, because the price, what we're really saying is that the price, say, of the S&P, let's just say it's 1,000, just to pick a round number. If the price of the S&P is 1,000, what is that 1,000? The 1,000 is, the 1,000 includes prior years where there have been gains. In other words, it started as a very low number. I don't know where it started, but you know what the first S&P number was, but it was very low. And then as gains were accrued, the number went up, up, up. Well, when you accrue another year of gains at the end of the next 12 months, it has to go up again by 6.5 real. And if only we were all rational, if all investors were rational, it really would go up 6.5 a year or something close to that. Some year 6, some year 7, but there wouldn't be that much difference. It would usually be something like 6.5. But it does make sense that the price goes up by 6.5, even though that gain was baked into the old price. There's a little. On the surface, it sounds like there's a paradox, but I think it makes sense. Now, I actually think, I'm not sure that you get into some complications, and people more skilled at numbers than I should address these questions. But I don't think the dividend should be included. It doesn't seem to me. In the S&P price increase, because the dividend is paid separately to the investor. So it seems to me, if the dividend were 3 and the total increase in value was 6.5, it seems to me the S&P would go up 3.5. But then there's also inflation, and inflation might have been 3, and that would mean that it would go back to 6.5. So I think the 6.5 number, it's certainly not precise, but it's sort of in the neighborhood of what you would expect, in my understanding. But whenever you get to numbers, you're on shaky ground listening to Rob Bennett. Please be careful whenever I cite numbers. I've learned to be, so I hope you will learn to be. All right, now I want to get to the new podcast, 163, Buffett Disappoints. Buffett is really a small part of this. I just use Buffett Disappoints as my title because it signifies something much larger than Warren Buffett. But Warren Buffett does something. Oh, I meant to pull up. I didn't do it. I should have done this, but it doesn't matter. But I did a blog entry a long time ago, a couple years ago, with the title Buffett Disappoints. And what I wanted to do here was to read from that. I could probably find it while I talked. I could do a search and pull it up, but it's I don't think it's necessary. You'll have to take my word. The only difference is I won't be able to quote his words. You'll just have to take my word on it. But if you wanted to do a Google search, you could find that what I'm saying is so. But Buffett, what happened is that Buffett was interviewed in one of the big magazines. I think it might have been Fortune, is my recollection, but I can't swear to that. And he answered in a way that made clear that Buffett understands why valuation-informed indexing is superior to passive indexing. He understands the principle. I don't know that Buffett's ever heard the word valuation-informed indexing, but he understands the principle. The principle is valuations affect long-term returns. If valuations affect long-term returns, it makes no sense to invest passively because the value proposition of stocks is changing with every change in valuations. Therefore, the risk you're taking on when you invest in stocks is greater at times of high prices. So why would you want to stay at the same stock allocation? It makes no sense. You should be adjusting your stock allocation. The thing that passive investors are passive about is their stock allocation. And to be passive about your stock allocation makes no sense because your stock allocation is the thing you need to get right in order to be successful in the long term. So you need to change that. And that's all that valuation-informed indexing is. It's just an approach to indexing in which you change your stock allocation, which is the rational thing to do. But Buffett was interviewed, and he was asked by the interviewer, I don't recall the question. As I said, I could pull up the blog entry, but it really doesn't matter. But he made a point that he makes all the time. And Buffett is one of my, you know, he's a genius. I don't think I'm certainly not the first person to say that. He's one of my favorite investing analysts of all time. I like him because he's a straight talker. Buffett's a straight talker, and you don't get enough of that in this field. My favorites, just if you're keeping records, number one is John Walter Russell. And I think some people, you know, have a skeptical eye when I say John Walter Russell is, I think, the most important investing analyst. I think people, you know, John Walter Russell's my partner. He's the guy that helps me develop the calculators. And he has a website, early-retirement-planning-insights.com. John has done all the statistical work that has helped us develop the valuation-informed indexing concept, and he's the numbers guy extraordinaire in the retire early and indexing discussion board communities. But a lot of people would say, hey, John Walter Russell, you know, he's some guy with a website, that's nice, but, you know, you're putting him up there with Warren Buffett and John Bogle, you know, who are you kidding? I think John Walter Russell's work is superior. I mean no dig at Buffett or Bogle or Shiller or anybody else. But the thing that John Walter Russell does different is he accounts for valuations in all his analysis. Shiller does that, but Shiller doesn't do very much in the realm of practical investing strategies. Shiller is mostly theory. The theory, you know, none of what I do would be possible without Shiller's work. So the theory is huge. But John Walter Russell does the practical side. He basically takes Shiller's ideas and reduces them to numbers. And so, in terms of what I do, I need them both. I couldn't live without either one of them. But Russell's work is a little more compelling to me because it's more specific. And Russell's work, Buffett also always deals with valuations. The approach to investing followed by Buffett is value investing. So obviously he's looking at valuations. But Buffett's work tends to be very sophisticated. He's telling people how to pick individual stocks, and I'm writing for the typical middle-class investor who doesn't want to do that. So Buffett's work, I couldn't do it without it. I couldn't do anything I do without Buffett having laid the groundwork, but Buffett's work is aimed at a different audience. So, you know, once I learned the basics of what Buffett has to say, I don't spend that much time studying him. I think it would be very profitable for you to study him, but it's not necessary to be an effective investor. In other words, you can get 80% of what you need for investing success without following Buffett, although you have to follow his principles. You have to understand that valuations matter. But as long as you get that, you don't have to study how to pick stocks. And so if you want to get a higher return than you get with indexes, I think you can do it by studying Buffett. But it's not necessary. That's optional. And I don't have the time to devote to it, so I don't. So again, I put Russell ahead of Warren Buffett. You know, that might sound shocking, but it's sincere. Sincere evaluation on my part. And the same thing's true with Bogle. Bogle has the benefit that he writes for the average person. His investing ideas are aimed at the typical middle-class investor, the group that I'm aiming mine at. So his work is very important. However, Bogle doesn't count valuations. So for that, you've got to, again, go to Russell. So, you know, Russell's number one in my book. And I don't say that, you know, I think sometimes I say it and people think I'm joking, and I'm not. I understand that it hits people funny, but it's not a joke. I think John Walter Russell's site is the most important website on planet Internet. And, of course, I don't know all the websites. So, you know, maybe there's some great cartoon website I know nothing about. But I think this economic crisis is a big deal. And his website would help us out of the economic crisis if people would, you know, take it seriously and learn from it. So that's my take. And I'm going to, when I do my podcast, I give my take. Gosh darn it. So Russell's number one. Schiller's number two for obvious reasons. He, you know. He's the guy who gives us the theoretical knowledge we need to make everything run properly. Buffett, I would put number three, because as I say, I just he does do value in investing, which I think is the best of all investing strategies. I think it's better than valuation-informed indexing, but it's harder. So I focus on the easier approach because I'm a slacker by nature. And then fourth, I would put Bogle because I think Bogle revolutionized investing when he gave ideas that, you know, he opened stock investing up to the average person. That's what I think Bogle's big contribution was. And he gave us, you know, well, he gave us indexes, which, you know, we need it to make that work. And then fifth, I would put Rob Arnott, who is just a real truth teller. And Rob Arnott does sort of combine all the elements of those other names, and he does give practical investing information. So Rob Arnott combines it all pretty effectively. All right, but so that's just to give you an idea where Buffett stands in my estimation. He ranks, you know, very, very high, not quite as high as John Walter Russell, but, you know, up there, you know, and that's how I feel about it. So when Bogle speaks, Rob Bennett listens and lots of other people listen. And Bogle was being interviewed. I think it was in Fortune. And they asked him something. And he said, and I say, this was several years ago. This was before the crash. And he says, you know, the thing I believe is you should be fearful when others are greedy. And you should be greedy when others are fearful. Okay? And that's valuation-informed indexing. That's the whole deal. You know, summed up in a phrase. The idea of valuation-informed indexing is to lower your stock allocation when prices are high, which means you're being fearful, properly so. You're being fearful when others are greedy. When the stock price is bid up too high, others are being greedy. They're trying to get more than 6.5 real. The economic growth only justifies 6.5 real per year, and investors are getting greedy, and they're grabbing more than that, and that's pushing the P10 level up, and so you want to become fearful because you're afraid of this greed because you know it's going to destroy us. It's going to destroy the market, and it's going to destroy the economy because the market is a big part of the economy. And then, of course, you want to be greedy when others are fearful. When the P10 level gets down to 8, half a fair value, you know, why not? You should get a little greedy because the returns are so extraordinary. Most likely return when you're at a P10 level of 8 is 15% real per year. So grab it. And your greed in that circumstance is not a negative thing. Your greed is helping get the economy back on its feet. When we have a P10 level of 8, we're usually, you know, in a pretty deep recession. And that means we need to get people buying stocks and people are scared to death. And we need to have some people step forward. And fortunately, we do have a percentage of the population that keeps their allocations low at times of insane prices. And they've got money to invest. And they save the economy from cratering. I wish we had more of them. So Buffett and Rob Bennett, you know, are simpatico. But there's a problem. And I can't quote him. As I said, I'd have to go to the earlier blog entry. But he basically said, be fearful when others are greedy. Be greedy when others are fearful. He said, or at least, something like, or at least, you know, he says, be greedy when, be fearful when others are greedy. Or at least, you know, don't be as greedy as everybody else. Or something like that, you know. In other words, he's sort of, he made the point that needs to be made, that you need to be fearful when others are greedy. But then he sort of pulled away from it. He took a curve at the end. And the curve is intellectually unjustified. And I think he did that because, well, I can't read his mind. Understand, if I say why he did something, I'm speculating. But Buffett knows perfectly well that valuations affect long-term returns. It's impossible that Warren Buffett doesn't understand this. His entire career is built on this insight. And I think it's, I don't know, I think it's true of a lot of the experts that they understand this. It's not possible that they don't. But when you say that somebody understands something, you always have a question of how well do they understand it, and that's a different question. And somebody like John Bogle, I don't know. I don't know. He has to understand it. And there's lots of evidence that almost all of the big passive investing advocates, they understand that valuations affect long-term returns. You can tell by the word games they employ that whenever the subject of valuations come up, it's like a crucifix to a vampire. They start covering their face. They're scared. They're run. You know, so they get it, but. You know, if you really think they get it, then we've got a worse situation than I believe. Because if they really get it and they're deliberately telling people to invest passively, knowing how much human misery it's going to cause, we've really got a mess on our hands. My take is that they get it and they know there's a problem, but they don't want to know. And so they sort of shut their ears. They start hearing about valuations and they're like, I don't want to hear that. They know there's a problem. They haven't run the numbers. They don't want to run the numbers. And if they ever hear the numbers, they sort of tune it out. They don't. They force themselves not to reflect on it. And as a result, their knowledge is weak. The knowledge in this area is weak. That's how it's a scandal. But that's how somebody like Rob Bennett, some guy who posts stuff on the internet, is able to race ahead of all these big name experts. And his understanding of stock investing, because they do not want to know. Now, I don't know how much they know. There's no way to know. But I know that Buffett knows that valuations matter. And of course he says it. I mean, you have to give him credit. He did say you should be, fearful when others are greedy. I mean, he is giving you a clue, but the whole point of this podcast is, the phrase I use is, Buffett disappoints. What that means is, yes, he's got it right, he understands it, and if you know that this stuff matters, it helps. But most people don't know. Most people haven't studied it. And when he says anything, and all of us have a get-rich-quick impulse that make us want to believe that valuations don't matter. We all want to believe that we can eat 6 pieces of chocolate cake every day and not get fat. And we all want to believe that we can passively and it can work. That we don't have to lower our stock allocations when prices go to the moon. We all want to believe that. And Buffett, essentially, the way he phrased it in the interview, and I can't quote him, but the idea was, he said, be fearful when others are greedy, or at least don't be too greedy. It was something like that. The way he phrased it, let us off the hook. Let us off the hook. And what I'm trying to do is get us back on the hook. The point of this podcast is, stop letting us off the hook, Warren Buffett. Stop letting us off the hook, John Bogle. To the extent he does it, stop letting us off the hook, Robert Shiller. I think even Shiller does this to a small extent, much smaller than most. Stop letting us off the hook. If we are goofing up, and we are, and we're goofing up bad, tell us. That's the job. Now, be a man. Don't flatter. I don't at all mean to suggest that Warren Buffett is particularly guilty of this. He's not. It's just that he has a higher responsibility because he's so well respected. He has more influence. And so when he says it, it really hurts. And don't think the passive investing dogmatics don't know it. I posted at Vanguard Diehards a long time. And they like to portray passive investing as scientific, you know, as, oh, it's got studies, academic studies, you know. And they know that Warren Buffett is respected. And if Warren Buffett would stand on a stage every year, you know, he does that thing where, you know, the investors in Berkshire Hathaway are able to show up and ask questions once a year. And if every year he would start out with a speech saying, I am terrified by the fact that the stock selling industry is devoting hundreds of millions of dollars to promoting passive investing. This must stop before we destroy our economy. That would get written up in the papers. And eventually, we would turn things around. But instead, what he does is he talks about other subjects, and then when he's asked the question, he answers more or less honestly. It's an honest answer to say, be fearful when others are greedy. But then he throws a little curve and he says, or at least don't be too greedy. And what happens? All the people who want to eat six pieces of chocolate cake a day, all the people who want to believe passive can work, the people who want to believe in a fantasy, they say, ah, Warren Buffett just said it's okay. He said you don't have to change your stock allocation. It's all right what we're doing. And they say it because I've been there. They say it. And another thing Buffett does, he does this frequently. He says, they'll say, what should the average person be doing? He'll say, I think the average person should be an index fund. Now, index funds are wonderful. So that's good advice. Again, on the surface, it's totally right. But a lot of the passive investing advocates, they treat the word index and invest passively as being synonymous. They're not. To index is to diversify, to get huge diversification at low cost. That's indexing, and that's wonderful. And I'm glad that Buffett endorses it. It's to his credit because he doesn't index. He picks individual stocks, but he's humble enough to point out that the average person is better going with a different approach. So that's great. But when it seems to me that he should know that these people are going to grab his endorsement of indexing and turn it into an endorsement of passive investing. So if it were me being asked that question, I would say, look, indexing's great. I love it. But don't index passively. And Buffett doesn't do that. He doesn't include the caveat, just be sure you don't follow that Bogle approach because that's passive and that's going to kill you. That's the part he leaves out. And that's what's killing us. That there are only so many people who understand that passive cannot work. I don't know what percentage of the population it is. My sense is it's 10 or 20%. It's a relatively small percentage of the population. Most people don't study investing. They're investing their 401k money because they have to. And they don't study it. And they hear all these quote-unquote experts saying passive investing is the way to go, efficient market theory, blah, 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 blee, blee, blee. And they think they're smart people. They must know. And so say there's 10% that know that this is gibberish. This is dangerous. That 10% needs to speak up. And it needs to speak up with strong, uncompromising words. Kind words, I hope. Polite words. Warm words. Friendly words. But strong and firm and clear. That's why I say Buffett disappoints. Now, it's a phenomenon, as I say, it goes way beyond Buffett. I used to think of it as the Ben Solar problem. Ben Solar was a poster at Motley Fool, and he also was an active poster at the nofeeboards.com. And Ben Solar was a great poster. And he was one of the, John Graney had a phrase for four of us. He hated four of us. And what did he call us? I'm thinking the four mop tops, but it wasn't the four mop tops. I can't remember he had some phrase. It was insulting, the four morons, whatever it was. And, Rob Bennett was first on his list, but I think Ben's, I don't know if Ben Solar was second. It was Rob Bennett. Fool Me Once was in that group, the four, and I wish I could remember Grainy's phrase, the four whatever. And Fool Me Once, because Fool Me Once liked real estate, and people loved him. They loved him because he would talk about how to buy real estate, and Grainy didn't like that one little bit. And Ben Solar was in there because Ben Solar would talk about valuations effectively. And I guess John Walter Russell was the other one, I imagine. And we were the four something, and I like I say, the funny posts are always my favorite. And I came up with once, I changed his phrase and I called it, instead of the four whatever it was, four idiots or whatever it was, I called it the four mop tops. And I compared us all to the Beatles. I gave each of us a Beatle personality. I was Paul because I like Paul the best. And I gave each of the four. And then I said, and this was uncharitable, but I said, I compared Grainy. I said, Grainy is the last, I had a little punchline at the bottom of the post. I said, Grainy is Perry Como. And I thought that was funny. But then later, I was feeling guilty about it. These things haunt me. And I went back and I said, maybe that was unkind to Perry Como. And I looked up on Wikipedia, Perry Como. They said Perry Como was a pretty nice guy. And they said a lot of people like this music. And so then I thought, well, I'm not going to say it. I'm not going to tell that anymore because that was. So now I'm telling it, but I'm letting you know. Perry Como, I don't know anything about Perry Como. I just picked his name out because I thought, the Beatles sort of killed whatever, I just heard the name Perry Como, and I said the Beatles must have really put a dent in his popularity. But anyway, Perry Como, I can't say I'm a fan, but I they had very nice things to say about him on Wikipedia. It made me feel bad that I joked about Perry Como. Anyway, so that's the I used to, but Ben Solar was a great poster, very, very smart, very very civil, extremely civil. He was great. But Ben Solar, and Ben Solar actually did some research. He did some original research that we benefited from. He did a lot. But eventually, after the ban on honest posting was imposed, he sort of went along with it. He would every now and then try to do something. He did try, but he basically just took this attitude of, what's the word for it? We need to placate the goons. In other words, the goons, can't stand to have the realities of stock investing discussed. So we're just going to have to accept that. And he knew it was wrong. At least he knew the numbers said it was wrong, and he certainly didn't have. I remember there was a post I put up saying that Grainy should be removed from Motley Fool, and it was a long thread, a very hot thread, very, very hot thread, and there was some viciously abusive stuff, and Ben Solar said, starting today, I'm going to report every abusive post because this is out of control. Motley Fool needs to know what's going on. And that was exactly the right thing to do. If he had stuck to that, I think it would have solved the problem. And if he had some people backing him up, 10 people backing him up, he said he was going to do it, but I think he did it for about one day and then he stopped, because of course once he started doing it, they started coming after him. He didn't like that. And then he stopped. And I mean, I don't mean to say that he's required to stick his neck out on the line, with people making death threats and all this sort of thing, but you got to do something. I can't tell people exactly what they should do, but you've got to do something because if honest posting is banned, the integrity of the board is compromised. And so you're damaging the whole board. And Ben Solar, this is to his discredit, he later became sort of a supporter of the ban. And I think, of course, the problem is once you tolerate it, once you go along with a ban on honest posting, you feel embarrassed that it's your integrity now in question. And then in the future, you're going to say, oh, well, we needed to ban honest posting, but you're not going to call it that. You're going to call it some other name. We needed to do such and such. And that's, see, this is what I think. I actually think this happens throughout the whole world of investing, all of investor world. We see it up close and personal on our boards. You can follow the post and see it in real time. But it's happening not just, it doesn't just happen on the internet. Human beings don't change just because they're on the internet. It happens everywhere. It happens, Shiller has said. He has never felt comfortable saying all that he believes about stock investing because he said he would be viewed as, quote, unprofessional if he did so. So Shiller pulls his punches. He says a lot of great stuff, but he doesn't say it all. And that's sort of what Ben Solar was doing. And people really don't like to talk about the abuse of posting. That's because it looks so bad. It looks so bad that it's almost unspeakable. But the unspeakable thing isn't that it happened. The unspeakable thing is that we tolerate it. It's only a small number of people who have engaged in it. And of course, if we all spoke up against it, it wouldn't continue for so long. And then it wouldn't be so unspeakable. So the point here is, a lot of people try to, go along to get along, so to speak. And Ben Solar did it on our boards. And Warren Buffett, I think, does it. Warren Buffett understands that valuations affect long-term returns, but he doesn't speak out in strong, uncompromising language against passive investing. And because he doesn't, passive investing grows and grows and grows, and it becomes the monster that ate the U.S. economy. And then it's hard to speak out. You know, it really is hard to speak out now, because if you tell people the story now, all the people who advocated passive investing have to say, hey, I caused the second biggest economic crisis in U.S. history. But if you had spoken out at an earlier time, things would have never reached that state. So this idea that you don't need to speak out is dangerous. And, is that an investing question? I say it is. See, a lot of people would say, well, you know, that's not investing. That's just, that's human interaction stuff. You know, as long as Buffett has the numbers right, he doesn't have any obligation to speak out that John Bogle, is ignoring valuations or that Vanguard Diehards is banned on his posting or that, this kind of thing. I say he does, because if Vanguard Diehards bans on his posting, or if Mel Lindauer engages in abusive posting and others tolerate it, that affects what we all can learn about investing. It affects the message we hear, because from that point forward, you're not getting all sides of the story. You're having a discussion of some of these questions. The goons bring this up all the time. They say, oh, Rob, there's a discussion of valuations today on Bogleheads. There are discussions of valuations, but the best people, the ones who are most knowledgeable, have all been banned. So you're not hearing from them. And the ones that are least knowledgeable or that, don't want to accept that valuations matter, they're welcomed, warmly welcomed. So they're speaking up. And a lot of people that are not banned but are knowledgeable, are silencing themselves. They engage in self-censorship. You're never going to get the straight story so long as punishments are imposed on those who tell the straight story, with no chaser. But unless people start to stand up and say, hey, we want to hear both sides, the punishments are going to continue. The abuse of posting is going to continue. So you really have to address that side of the matter. Now, I wanted to make a comparison, which it's a little strange, but I think it's there and it's relevant. And it's on death panels. Now we're talking about, I'm recording this podcast September 1, and the death panel question came up in connection with healthcare, health reform, the legislation that President Obama is advocating. And August was a contentious month, all these town hall meetings. And by the time you hear the podcast, you won't be hearing it for at least a month, maybe 2 months. It may be that the healthcare, I don't know what's going to happen. May it pass by then, maybe taken off the table, I don't know. Compromise may have come out. So I just don't know. But I've struggled with talking about political questions because I don't want anyone to feel that they're not welcome here because of their political views. We've had wonderful posters in our community who are liberal. We've had wonderful posters who are conservative. We've had wonderful posters who are moderate. And I love each and every one of the people who have advanced our knowledge. So that I'm reluctant because, I'm the owner of PassionSaving.com, that people may feel intimidated you know, to offer views other than my own on politics, so I don't want anyone to feel that way. However, I also want people to know that it's not a political site, and I'm not going to encourage political posting. But the only time when I feel there are certain situations where I feel I have to talk about politics or sometimes religion, because they're delicate subjects, but they help us to understand investing. And so when I need an example, I'm going to have to pull from that. And I'll try to do so gingerly, you know, and keep evidence respect for other viewpoints. I think I have an obligation to try to do that. Certainly not to be sarcastic or, you know, have put downs or anything of that nature. That's uncalled for, and I won't accept it among others. I'll hold myself to that, and I'll also hold others to that. You know, when I'm moderating what comments appear. Well, Sarah Palin came out with a comment. I think she wrote it at Facebook, and she said that she was objecting to death panels in the health reform legislation. And there were a lot of people that said, oh, no, 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 there's no death panels. This is stupid. You know, there's no such thing. It's a lie. A lot of people said it was a lie. And it's not a lie, in my opinion. You know, I guess I have to say that, but it's not a lie. She did not say that the phrase death panels is in the bill. I read her Facebook thing. It was about four paragraphs. And if I could take the time to read it, all these experts saying that it's not in there could have taken the time to read it. She never said that, you know, Joe Smith is going to be appointed to the death panel. She was, you know, I think she even used the word death panel in quotes. What she was saying was, if you have a government takeover of health care, the deficit is huge, you know, getting huger by the week. And there are a bunch of constraints, and there's going to be rationing of healthcare. It's inevitable, and that's just, you know, I often say the human mind cannot imagine any way that passive investing could work in the long term. Well, the same thing's true with this question. The human mind cannot imagine how there's not ultimately going to be rationing, and people, of course, know this. And so it's clear to me that the death panel comment, it must have polled, it must have brought the polls down for the health reform, because they took language out. They said, there's no death panel, no death panel. Oh, and by the way, we're taking it out. There's no death panel, and we're taking it out anyway, so don't worry about it. But they clearly had bad polling, because they reacted to that very quickly. Within, I don't know, it was 3-5 days, less than that, maybe. They took that out. You know, there wasn't any death panel language, but there was language suggesting, you know, things along this line. But my point is, there's two points. One, this idea, you know, I have a podcast called Taboo, which is all about things that cannot be spoken. And that's what we had. That's what we have with the whole question of the old school retirement studies get the numbers wrong. It's taboo. You're not allowed to say it. You're not allowed to point out that valuations affect long-term returns, and therefore the conventional investing wisdom of the last 30 years is wrong and dangerous. And the same thing's true with death panels. You know, we all know that there's going to be rationing, and if there's going to be rationing, there are going to be death panels of some nature. Someone's got to make the choices who gets in and who gets out. But we can't talk about it. And I think this is bad. There was a column that I saw about it. I believe it was written by a guy. I believe I read this at Pajamas Media. I think it's a website, and it's a libertarian site, I would call it. And they have a writer there who writes from the liberal side, not so much from the libertarian. And I think his name is I may get it wrong. It's something like. I hate it. It'd be bad if I get it wrong. It was something like Ron Rosenbaum, something like that. And he's sort of their, you know, their liberal. They keep him there because they want to have different viewpoints expressed. But he wrote a very good column on this, on the death panel question. And he said, you know, he pointed out that there's another guy who writes, I think, for the New York Observer. I believe his name is Joe Conanson. And I didn't read the Conanson column, but I read this summary of it. And Joe Conanson argued, as a liberal, in favor of the Obama plan, he argued that if you don't like government death panels, you know, do you like insurance company death panels? In other words, if the government doesn't take over healthcare, there's going to be rationing by insurance companies. Now, that is an effective argument, in my opinion. In other words, Sarah Palin was putting forward a fear that people have, not a lie. It's that people are genuinely afraid of this. This is it's not the only reason why people are uneasy about health reform. They're uneasy about the deficit, clearly. They're uneasy about the expansion of government. So, you know, there's a lot of different things going on. But there is no question but that rationing is an issue. And the problem, in my view, is I think a lot of the people at those town halls that are opposing health care could be brought to support it, depending on the nature of the bill. But the underlying thing here, the underlying thing is trust. If you're, you know, health reform is this big thing, you know, I think 16% of the U.S. economy or something. I don't know. I think I've heard that number. Big deal. And the big problem is a lot of people don't trust what they hear from their political leaders. They don't trust. In other words, you can't, you know, everybody talks about, did you read the bill? Nobody, you know, every citizen's not going to read a 10,000-page bill. That's just preposterous. So ultimately, it has to come down to trust. You have to say, look, I know this guy's a good guy, and if he likes it, it must be good. But when you duck the questions, when the questions are never aired out, you can't develop trust. And I think this is a problem in our political system. I've told the story before about how I used to be involved in politics. I was a reporter up on Capitol Hill, and for a short time I was a lobbyist, and I sort of got disgusted with politics because it was all kabuki theater. You know, people would talk every year about doing something about the deficit. They'd go these long speeches about how important it is, and we're all doomed unless we do something about it. And then, you know, they would duck the question at the end of the year, and they would do it over and over and over again. You know, year after year after year, and you just got to a point, you said, why listen, how many times can you listen to the same speech? And it goes nowhere. And so I guess my point here is we should be talking about the death panels, not that we should be saying, oh, you know, we got to defeat healthcare. There are two sides to the story. Those who favor the Obama plan certainly should make the argument that if the government's not rationing, it's going to be the insurance company's rationing. That's a perfectly legit. Now, there are arguments there that can be made that it's better that the government not do it, but there are also arguments it's better that the government do it. There's arguments both ways. But we cannot work through our fears and our concerns unless we talk. And what frustrated me about politics was not that one side won or the other side won, it was that neither side was really addressing the most important questions. And the joke was on me because I got into financial freedom and I said, you know, in this field, there won't be any of this ugliness. All the divisiveness comes from that. The refusal to talk about the things that matter. Because instead of talking about it, they say, well, you're a liar if you say there's death panels. And of course, when you call people liars, then they become alienated. And then when they come to your town hall meeting, they're shouting at you instead of talking with you because they don't trust you. And the same thing happens, amazingly, the same thing happens in this area of in this area of investing. Everybody knows that valuations affect long-term returns. It's universally understood, and people don't talk about it, and because they don't talk about it, it gets worse, and then you have to engage in all this nastiness. But it's this taboo subject, and it becomes empowered. Whatever becomes taboo becomes empowered. So the valuation question has become like nuclear. But it shouldn't be. We should talk about it. Now, what I wanted to give it. there's a connection here, you know. So because I lived through this experience of seeing how this was done in politics and then moved to the investing, well, the financial freedom area and found the same thing applies, and it sort of amazed me. And so I'm always interested in what the connection is. And I don't see any direct connection. It's not a partisan thing. It's not a partisan thing. It's something going on in our society. And it's hard to figure out. I think about it, but I can't figure it out. But I'm going to quote. I'm a quote from a Peggy Noonan column. Peggy Noonan is a columnist for the Wall Street Journal. I think she was a speechwriter for Ronald Reagan. But she wrote a column. This was some years ago. I'll look at it. Maybe if you want to look it up. The title is a separate piece. This is Peggy Noonan, Noonan. And the date of the column was October 27th, 2005. But it's an incredible column. She talks about elites who believe, she speculates, that the wheels are coming off the car, is the way she phrases it, that the United States is going down. And a lot of elites believe this, but it's taboo. It's not spoken about. What, you know, I mean, it's scary to read this. And she had one quote, and I quoted this as my Passion of the Day item when I found this. I happened to come across this. I was linked to it from another article. But I want to quote this. Yeah, here it is. Do people fear the wheels are coming off the trolley? Is this fear widespread? A few weeks ago, this is Peggy Noonan. A few weeks ago, I was reading Christopher Lawford's lovely, candid, and affectionate remembrance of growing up in a particular time and place with a particular family, the Kennedys, circa roughly 1950 to 2000. It's called Symptoms of Withdrawal. At the end, he quotes his Uncle Teddy. Christopher, Ted Kennedy, and a few family members had gathered one night and were having a drink in Mr. Lawford's mother's apartment in Manhattan. Teddy was expansive. If he hadn't gone into politics, he would have been an opera singer, he told them, and visited small Italian villages and had pasta every day for lunch. Singing at La Scala in front of 3,000 people throwing flowers at you, then going out for dinner and having more pasta. Everyone was laughing. Then writes Mr. Lawford, Teddy, quote, took a long, slow gulp of his vodka and tonic, thought for a moment, and changed tack. Quote, I'm glad I'm not going to be around when you guys are my age. I asked him why, and he said, because when you guys are my age, the whole thing is going to fall apart. Mr. Lawford continued, the statement hung there, suspended in the realm of maybe we shouldn't go there. Nobody wanted to touch it. After a few moments of heavy silence, my uncle moved on. And then Peggy Noonan says, and forgive me, I thought, if even Teddy knows. Well, she's saying something very scary here. It scares me. I've talked about this sort of fear. I mean, you know, on the political level, the whole fact that I got so disgusted with politics. Not, as I say, not left or right. I started out liberal, very liberal. Became more conservative over the years. So today I'm more in the conservative camp. But it wasn't partisan. My disgust. It was bipartisan. It was just the system doesn't work. And so I just elected to disengage, get involved in a different field. And then I found the same thing going on in the investing field, which ultimately does, you know, merge a little bit with the political field. Because when the stock market crashes, it hurts the economy. And when the economy crashes, it hurts, you know, our political, it hurts trust in our political system. And so if there are people out there in positions of authority, positions of influence, who believe that the wheels are coming off the trolley, who believe that our system is going down, they should be trying to do something about it. And the suggestion that Peggy Noonan is making is that either they don't feel they can do anything, so they're just personally sort of saying, look, there's nothing can be done, or they're, you know, more cynically, that they're saying, oh, I got mine, buddy, you know, and I'm just going to make a few more bucks for however many years it lasts, and that'll be that. I'm not going to comment, really, I don't think, because the one part that most has always scared me is nuclear war, because, you know, I don't know how you get around that. It seems to me sooner or later there's going to be a war, and when there's a war, there's nuclear weapons, and where does that take us? So that part has always scared me. The rest, I sort of feel you can overcome. You know, we could have a depression and we could overcome it. We could have a terrible disease, you know, a plague, and we could overcome it. Human beings have survived a lot of bad things. And so I think we can overcome it. But nuclear war, I don't know. I don't see how, really. I suppose it could blow up part of the world and the other part would survive. But if the part that survives still has nuclear weapons, I just don't know. So I have these worries, but, you know, maybe I'm like everybody else. My attitude is there's nothing that can be done. But the thing that I focus on more, and the thing that I think Ted Kennedy was talking about, was more the budget deficit. In other words, as a system, I don't think he was really talking about nuclear war. I think he was talking about, we all know that the budget deficit is totally out of hand. It's not due to one president. It's not due to one party. It's been a bipartisan effort going back, you know, 30 years or whatever. It's a total disaster, and it's getting worse, and nobody ever talks about it. Or they talk about it, but they're not serious. They talk about it, but it's all covered in murk and vagueness, and there's no specific proposal. And if a specific proposal came up, the guy who brought it up would be banished. The real problems are taboo, and that's what I see in the investing area. Everyone knows that valuations affect long-term returns. Rob Bennett didn't have to come along to say that. And if valuations affect long-term returns, everyone knows, everyone has a brain, the market is inefficient. And if the market is inefficient, our whole model is wrong. That's a problem, people. And people in positions of influence need to address this. And this is why the title of the podcast is Buffett Disappoints. Buffett's not the worst. He's one of the best. But Buffett is in a position of influence. And, you know, forgive me for telling Warren Buffett what he needs to do, but I think Warren Buffett needs to stand up to the plate and tell people this passive investing stuff is for the birds. Because we can't have an honest conversation so long as there are people pretending that it makes sense not to change your stock allocation in response to price changes. It's a big problem. You know, I happen to get caught in the middle of it unintentionally, but it's a big problem. It's a problem for everyone because you can give the best investing advice in the world, and if the whole U.S. system goes down, your investing strategies aren't going to work, no matter how smart they are. All of us who benefit from our economic and political system have a responsibility to do what we can when that system is at jeopardy. And it's at jeopardy. Run the numbers. Run the numbers. Stocks were overvalued in January of 2000, something to the tune of $12 trillion in today's dollars. Something in that neighborhood. There are going to be millions of people who are going to suffer busted retirements because of the demonstrably false numbers put forward in the old school safe withdrawal rate studies. And I went public in May of 2002 about these errors, and I doubt that I was the first person who discovered them. I doubt that very seriously. So we should be talking about them. Well, the last point I'll make, and I'll drop it, drop the sermon, go back to something, I don't know, cutting edge or strategy or funny, look for something. I had a blog called the Sci-Fi blog. It's a very well written blog. It's not sci-fi like science fiction. It's sci like psychology. PSI, Sci-Fi blog. It's a very extremely well written blog. I think it's the best written blog I've seen, and it's about behavioral finance, a theme I'm very interested in. But the guy who writes it, you know, I put a comment there. I think it was yesterday, and the guy who writes it, you know. He came on and he was kind. He said, you know, your comments are always well done, Rob. But he said something that was right in line with this Buffett disappoints problem. He said, he didn't deny. See, I noticed these things. And of course, anyone with a brain can notice them. I'm not the only one. He didn't deny that valuations affect long-term returns, like I was saying. But he said, Rob, all the studies show that when investors time the market, they do just the wrong thing. Instead of buying when prices are low and selling when prices are high, they do just the opposite. they are, you know, they're greedy when others are greedy, and they're fearful when others are fearful. They don't do what Buffett recommends. And he's right. He's right. But the question is, why is that? The suggestion of the guy who writes the sci-fi blog is it's because investors are incapable of investing rationally. That's the implicit suggestion. He's saying these studies show they do the wrong thing, therefore we better not tell them that they have to time the market. He didn't say those words. I'm adding that part. But I think it was implicit. And I say just the opposite. I have never seen evidence that middle-class investors are not capable of reining in their emotions. The problem is it's hard to rein in your emotions. When stocks are going up 20, 30% a year, we've all got a get-rich-quick impulse within us, and we all want to think passive investing makes sense. We all want to stick at those insane stock allocations. Of course we do. But have we ever tried telling people the dangers, providing them calculators so that they can look at what the numbers say, educating investors, getting the message out day after day after day, you must time the market, you must time the market, you must time the market, you must time the market. If we did it, it would work, I believe. Certainly it's worth a try. So it's frustrating. This guy is informed. He obviously knows about behavioral finance. So, behavioral finance is the opposite of passive investing. Passive investing ignores emotion. Behavioral finance pays attention to it. But the most important thing of behavioral finance is we're all going to be emotional basket cases as long as the experts are telling us we can invest passively and it can work. We don't need to change our stock allocation. That's the only thing, that's the most important thing an investor does is set his allocation. And if you buy into the passive model, you're getting the most important thing wrong before you start. It's your first choice. You're going down the emotional path. Well, where do you think you're going to end up? You're going to end up, more and more and more emotional as time goes on. So, this question used to come up with the Bogleheads. John Bogle would come out every now and then, and John Bogle has a conscience, and he would deliver a speech, and he would use code language to tell people, look, he'd say, oh, you should be nervous. You should be worried. And so what he's telling people is you got to lower your stock allocation. But he can't say that because if he says the magic words, lower your stock allocation, he's not passive anymore, is he? So he would use this code language. Now, some people, I don't doubt, they did it. But that was maybe 10% of the people on the board. If Bogle had said, lower your stock allocation, for God's sake, 90% would have done it. There's always going to be some who are going to invest passively no matter what we do. The poor will be with us always. The passive investors will be with us always. The emotional investors will be with us always. But we could do a lot better. I think we could do better with health reform if we would talk about the issues. I think we could unite. Some people are going to say, I'm so idealistic, so naive. But I think it's not the people that are broken. It's the system that's broken. I think we have a lot of common ground on a lot of issues, including healthcare. Nobody would get everything they wanted. But people could, if we restored trust, people would be willing to offer compromise. But when trust goes, it all goes. When trust goes, communication goes. And when communication goes, what happens is a policymaker is making a speech, and the person hearing it is hearing something different than what he's saying because he filters it. And the people who, support Obama are hearing something very different than the people who support Palin. When Palin gives a speech and when Obama gives a speech. And you can't get to first base. When in the reality is, a lot of those people, they don't have interests totally aligned. They don't. But many of their interests are aligned. So we've got to address that trust issue to make our political system work. Well, we need to address the trust issue to make our investo world work. And I think the thing we most need to address is, should investors be changing their stock allocations in response to big price changes? Or, more simply put, do valuations affect long-term returns? We need to break this taboo. We need some brave, influential people to step forward to make it happen. And Warren Buffett could obviously be one. John Bogle could obviously be one. But any of us can do our part. Any of us. So, that's today's sermon. Hope you enjoyed it. Good luck with your investing strategies.